This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk with me, Dan Clark. Now, I've been away for a couple of weeks, as some of my regular listeners will notice. I went away for work reasons, but I was lucky enough to catch up with an old friend of mine. He's a comedian, a writer, an actor, just a generally very, very funny man. There's some people in life who say funny, some people who do funny. He's actually both of them, but he is one of the funniest men on the planet when it comes to just doing funny. He's just got funny bones and a very clever, lovely man. I am talking, of course, of Mr. Rich Fulcher. You'll know him mostly, probably in this country, from his contributions, appearances in The Mighty Boosh. Bob Fossil being one of his regular characters, but he's also written a book, written and starred in sketch shows. He's been in loads of stuff, so we had a lot to chat about. I caught up with him in LA, we had a lovely chat. Now, since I've been away, many things have happened, but one of them that's dear to my heart and saddened me when I heard the news was the death of Gene Wilder. Now, I know we've all just talked about him and we've all posted, our favourite clips of things that he did from his films, but I want to talk about him just briefly because he was such a huge inspiration to me when I was a kid. And then as I entered my teens, his films had a whole new meaning to me. He's in like four or five of what are considered the all-time classic comedies. And I think the thing that gets me about, like, he was 82, right? So it's not like it was a tragic death. The man, anyone that gets to live until they're 82, that's an amazing life. Sad that he died because of, I think it was dementia that he had, but it's not like a tragedy. He didn't die really young, but it's still sad because the reason it's sad for me is because I feel like in the last 10 years, we didn't celebrate Gene Wilder enough. And it's not until someone like him passes away, someone that we've kind of not forgotten about, but we certainly don't think about all the time. It's not until they go that we all then start going, oh, he's amazing, he's great. And I just hope that Gene knew how much everyone loved him. It filled my heart with so much warmth when I saw just how much people loved him on the internet, all the celebrities, all the comedians, writers, directors, how much people were inspired by him, influenced by him, just loved him. And I just hope he knew that before he went. I remember feeling the same way about Rick Mayall when he passed away. He hadn't really been doing as much stuff in his, last few years, maybe a decade, and partly due to the accident he had. And when he passed away, it was like everyone in the UK, everyone was talking about just what a huge influence he was, what an amazing performer he was, how he was the man in the 80s. He was the comedy man. And I just kind of hope that Rick knew when he passed away that he meant that much to people. Because we don't say it all the time if there's no reason to. If you don't know if someone's ill, or you just don't say it, you know. I could get really sappy and start saying, hey, we need to tell each other we love each other all the time. But I do hope Gene knew that. And the other weird thing is I was reminded of the fact that a couple of years ago, I was asked by the comedy website Chortle to pick a playlist, they called it, a comedy playlist. And it was just of all the people that have influenced me and all the comedians and comedies that I love. And weirdly, I picked like seven. So if you just Google Chortle Dan Clark playlist, comedy playlist or something, you'll see it yourself. There's some stuff I talked about. But I think like the first three are Rick Mayall, Gary Shandling, specifically the Larry Sanders Show, and Gene Wilder. They're like three of my heroes. And they've all since they've all passed away. And anyone else that's on that list, I just want to say, please be safe. Please make sure you look in the sky that there aren't any pianos that removal men are dangling, and, you know, just make sure they're not going to fall on you. Just live healthy and well, because at the moment my list is slowly dwindling away. Now, to kickstart the show, I would like to play a song sung by Mr. Wilder himself. This isn't what you're expecting. Normally people would probably play a song from Willy Wonka, because that's where he's most famously sung before. And that is a film I love dearly, and I love the songs in that film. But I was rewatching Stir Crazy the other day. It's not one of the films people would say is an absolute classic, but having rewatched a lot of his films, I think it still holds up as certainly one of the funniest. And it's not a perfect film, but for me, it's definitely one of... I'd actually put it in one of my top... If someone asked me to do a top 10 comedy films of all time, I think I might put it in there, because it just has so many funny moments. Anyway, so this is from the opening credits of Stir Crazy. He sings the song. This is called Crazy, I think.
Who needs Hollywood? I hear they're really nuts out there. Give me a town like old New York, with lots of trees and clean fresh air. I need a place where love is everywhere. They say I'm crazy, just a little bit out of whack, 'cause I always like to act my dreams out. They call me a maniac. Well, if I'm crazy, what a wonderful way to be. Imagine all the possibilities if the whole world was just like me. Ooh, 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 crazy, crazy. Everyone thinks I'm crazy, but I've got a feeling deep inside they'd all like to be just like me. Crazy, 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 crazy. So once in a while, set yourself free. Who needs reality? They say I'm crazy. I study in imperfection, but I'm just trying to find a little affection. Wouldn't you like that too? People say I'm crazy, 'cause I say the first thing on my mind. I guess freedom is a serious crime these days. Well, lock the door and then throw away the key. I guess being crazy's best for me.
So here I am with Mr. Richard Fulcher, comedian extraordinaire. I'm actually, this is a first...
Say some more.
I've done the intro before we've spoken.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, it was really good.
It was awesome.
Oh my God, it was a 17-minute intro just about your career and all your different titles.
So the interview's over now.
Yeah. So okay. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me. God, that was good.
You were worried about doing this, and now
it was so quick and easy.
Yeah. So this is a first for this show. We're doing an outdoor interview in Los Angeles. A bit like Shakespeare in the Park, I guess.
Yeah, only it's a car park. But it's fun. It's all fun.
It is fun. So you miss living... You live here now, right?
Yes. Yeah. I moved out here around 2013. Yeah. But I like to say I'm based out here. I don't... You know, I move around.
Yeah.
So I moved out here, but I still work in the UK. Okay. And I could go back there any minute if I get in trouble here, you know, with my...
With the IRS.
Yeah, my offshore accounts and everything. Yeah, yeah. But...
Are you saying this just in case any producers in the UK are listening? I'm still available for work.
I'm still available. Hello.
Actually, you are still available because you've done quite a few things over the last year in the UK, right?
That's the irony. The minute you leave one place, that's when you get work in that place.
It's like a relationship, isn't it?
What?
You know, when they leave.
Then they want you back.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Who wants me back? What? Tell me.
Please tweet in if you want Rich back. Let's start a hashtag Rich Must Come Back campaign.
Well, you were going to ask if I miss London.
Yeah. Well, yes, I did. I think I asked it.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I missed the part of it that you can walk out of your flat or your house or your bungalow.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of bungalows in London.
And there's people around. You know, you can meet up with people. Yeah. Whereas here, it's like more of a, Wednesday the 16th
I've got
at
a window between, there's always windows, aren't there?
Yeah. Wait, it's 3:50. Our window was 3:45, so yeah. I'll see you later.
So what brought you here to come here sort of semi-permanently? We won't say
really?
No, what? Why? How come? Because you were London-based for like 10 years or something?
Yeah. About 10 years. Well, I'd always come back and forth, and I just thought, we'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different places to pitch things out here. Mm-hmm. I'm an idea man, Dan.
I know.
I've got ideas coming out the wazoo.
We're just sitting here outside a little coffee shop, and you've got a whiteboard. And you're pointing at ideas.
Sitcom in a car park.
Yeah, always. You're just on, aren't you? Just before we sort of talk about you, have you ever been serious about yourself in public for more than, say, 5 minutes?
No! Oh, no. Is this serious?
Before we talk about you, I did a little intro to this podcast about Gene Wilder because he passed away recently. Was he an influence on you at all?
Yeah. I mean, I loved all the Mel Brooks stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually saw him live in London. He was doing this laughter on the 23rd floor.
Right, the Neil Simon.
Yeah, band. And he was amazing.
Was he?
He's like a larger-than-life guy.
He's because I thought of you, because I've been thinking a lot about Gene Wilder. He was a huge, huge influence on me.
Were you like dead people? Are you one of those guys?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't that into him before. But
right,
now,
right.
I thought Rich must have liked Gene Wilder because he has that mania. And I think a lot of people would associate some of that like high energy performance with you as
well. Yeah, I like to think that, I do relate to that because he's like pent up and he's ready to explode any minute. Yeah. Just like now! That's me.
And yet he had something so...
And yet he was better than you,
he was
Rich.
Better than you in so many ways. Foolish to think that you...
I shouldn't have even done that comparison.
You know, I did it, actually. I led you into a full sense of security there. He meant a lot to me when I was a kid, and then he was sort of the gift that kept on giving because as a kid I loved Willy Wonka and... I weirdly loved Stir Crazy as a child.
Right, right.
Even though some of the slightly naughtier stuff went over my head.
Some of the Richard Pryor stuff.
His relationship with him?
No. I mean, I liked some of those movies earlier, but now when you look at them, they're,
What, questionable?
Slightly questionable.
Well, I rewatched Stir Crazy the other night, and I stand by this. I think it's a brilliant comedy.
That's right. We bad.
Yeah. Oh, shit. But what was I going to say? You made me lose my train of thought.
Car park.
So you... He was brilliant when I was a kid. And then as a teenager, when I discovered comedy on a different level, the same stuff he did... worked but on a new level when I was a teenager. Do you know
well
what I mean?
That happens quite a bit.
Yeah, like not all people have that appeal.
Oh really?
I don't think so, to all ages.
Yeah,
maybe they do, but he had a very special thing.
The writings of Proust were like that for me. When I first read them when I was 4 or 5, they just sort of washed over me.
Now you joke about this, right? But this is a very tenuous segue into. I was doing a little bit of. I know Rich. I've known him for years. But I should probably just look up and see, you know, First thing I read is that you went to university, you studied law. Now,
yes, I did.
I had no idea you were clever.
I'm not. You don't have to be clever to study law, do you?
Are you? Well, you can't be. You need to read for a start, right?
Yeah. But this is so funny because all my life, even though I loved comedy and everything, I mean, I would watch, you know, Monty Python all the time. I memorized it all. And I always thought I was going to be a lawyer. You know, like, this is all frivolous comedy stuff.
Well, I was going to ask that. Why do some people who go to, like, you get it a lot with the Oxbridge crowd. They go to Oxford or Cambridge. They study something like science or history.
And then they get drunk.
And then they become comedians. And you're like, was that not just a waste of everybody's time, and studying?
Some of it's parental pressure. Like, my dad always thought if you get a Bachelor of Science degree, that's always much better than a Bachelor of Arts.
Yeah.
Or artsy fartsy, as he might call it.
I mean, he may well have a point, you know.
But law was kind of an in-between thing. Like, it's a legitimate profession. And it took me a while to get over the fact, like, when I first went to law school, I realized right away that I hated it. I mean, it was nothing
how soon?
You like weren't, day one? Like, a couple of weeks.
Really?
Yeah. This is all, I have to read stuff, and it's all about cases, and it's just really fucking boring. I mean,
what did you think it was going to be?
It's like, you know, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you can do that kind of law, but most of the time, it's not in front of a jury.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more like just the same thing over and over again. And here's the thing, I wanted to do entertainment law, but then I started realizing it, like, why do entertainment law? Why not just do the entertainment?
Ah, okay.
Epiphany.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At what age?
And then I shit myself.
And people were like, this guy's funny.
I love this guy. Do that again. That reminds me of Wilder.
What age were you when you thought you wanted to be in law? Like, what? How? There were some professions where I think, as a kid, why would you think, yeah, I really want
to. Because I love to argue stuff. So I would always watch shows that,
Reading.
So maybe around 12 or so, I thought, oh, okay. I wanted to be a brain surgeon for a while. Just because I heard they made a lot of money and they got to cut open brains and stuff.
At the age of like 12, you thought this stuff?
Yeah, I pretty much thought, I'm going to be a lawyer.
This is amazing because I wouldn't even know. I don't think I knew what law was at the age of 12.
Well, see, I didn't either. I didn't when I was in law school. It was so weird. But then I stayed in law school and graduated.
Yeah.
It's 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, it costs people money to go to university.
Right, right.
It's 3 years of your life. So people that...
All right. Jeez.
But people that come out and go, no, but I want to be a comedian, you kind of think it's such a weird...
But here's the reason it was slightly ballsy is that some people go into a law firm or something and they go, I'm just going to do it for 2 years to pay off my loans and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want any of that because once you get into it, you're going to want to stay longer because it's even harder to break away.
Yeah. What's the Godfather quote? I tried getting out, but they pulled me back in. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because then it's a bigger deal. Like, oh, you're on the partnership track. You can make partner in 4 years. And so I just decided the minute I graduated, I had signed up for classes, like improv classes.
Okay. So at what point during your law degree did you realize you like comedy and want to perform it?
I did this is so cliche. I did the school talent show.
Love it.
And then by the third year, I was in charge of the whole thing. So instead of like Saturday Night Live, because it was on a Thursday, I called it Thursday Night Live.
Okay, good spin.
Yes.
I like it. Using a familiar brand, but creating your own thing with it.
See? Yeah. A lot of parody, a lot of funny sketches. There was one called Lawman instead of Rain Man.
Oh, man. You should pull this out again. I think that could work.
Oh.
There's a sitcom in that.
I love it. Keep. I'm going to put this on the whiteboard. Yeah. Give me a few minutes.
Okay. You performed whilst you're...
My girlfriend at the time said, do you know there's this place in Chicago called Second City and all these people like Bill Murray and John Candy, John Belushi, they went to it. And I started looking it up. I go, this is really cool.
By the way, how did you look things up back then before the internet?
I just went to the library.
And they had information about Second City in
the library. She also gave me some stuff, because I think she had been in Chicago or something. Okay. And
what year are we talking here?
We're talking 90s, early 90s.
Okay. Yeah.
So she basically, she didn't convince me, but I thought, this is what, I need to do something, and I need to do something tangible. That's not
I need to do something now.
No. So I just decided, I signed up for the classes my last year for the summer following graduation.
And where were you at university?
Oh, was it at Washington and Lee? It's like a little school in Virginia.
Okay.
And I'll cut that out?
Yeah, we don't know. That's boring. No, that's, was it an Ivy League school? No.
You weren't that
clever.
I went to an Ivy League undergrad, but okay. Yeah. Let's not talk about that.
Were you far from Chicago? Was that like a big thing to have to do?
Yeah, it was like, you know, I think everybody thought I was going to stay kind of close to home and, you know, work in a law firm. But I said, I'm going to Chicago.
To make stuff up in front of people?
No, I actually told my parents I was going to practice law in Chicago.
No way.
Yeah.
What, and how long did you keep that ruse
about
up?
5 years. 5 years.
Really?
Yeah. I actually wrote a show about it. It's called Mom, I'm Not a Lawyer.
No way.
Yeah, I had a friend that would answer calls for me. So she would pretend she was at the law firm and then call me.
And of course, back then, it would have been so much easier to keep a lie like that going.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your mum didn't just have to go on your Facebook page and see pictures of you in a black box theatre doing improv.
Nude.
Yeah. Wow, how did she take it when you finally...
Well, it was more... I sort of gradually got her groomed.
Okay. Right, okay, where's this going?
No, well, what I was... I just, you know, casually got in some things about showbiz and, you know, caught her, you know, temperature on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then she basically said, I knew it all along. Like,
like you'd just come out of the closet.
Yeah. No, seriously, I was thinking...
you were an improviser since you were 12.
I think I was going to say I was gay.
Yeah.
And then throw this out afterwards. Yeah, but, yeah. You know, yeah. But it all worked out. They're fine with it.
So you actually went to Second City.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
It's cool.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of other places there. And like in Chicago, they have so many improv schools.
What is Chicago? What is the connection between improv
Second
and
City?
So it began there and everyone else was like, we want a piece of that.
Well, there are other schools of thought. It's like religions. Like there's Improv Olympic, which uses this thing called the Herald, and there was the Annoyance Theater, and it's just like all these different kind of, like, acting schools in New York or London. There's different method acting, mm-hmm. and, you know.
I find it, even as a comedian that's done comedy for years, I didn't quite realize the art of improv in America. Until I came to LA a few years ago. And my girlfriend at the time, my girlfriend now.
Backtrack.
I mean, my girlfriend said
who's
to me.
Who's this woman next to you?
She said to me at the time when we were here, she said, we should go and see Groundlings. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's the improv. I know about that. But, you know, I'm not really into improv. Because back home, why is it?
It's
back
games.
In London,
it's all about
it's all games,
games,
isn't
yeah.
it? And it's just, we haven't got that training ground. And I went to see Groundlings, and it was honestly the funniest live comedy show I'd seen in years. Like, I was blown away.
Very funny.
Really funny, but also, you're sitting there going, how are they getting to funny bits so quickly?
It's scripted.
All of it.
Yeah. All improv is scripted in America.
Yeah.
No, but
with the 12 writers.
I've realized that improv is a lot like religion. Mm-hmm. Like, it has to get to a shore... and it's like missionaries have to spread the word.
Yeah.
Like in Australia, they only know about Keith Johnston in Canada and all of that, theater games and theater sports. Yeah. Whereas in Chicago, they're just start, like UCB's an offshoot of the Chicago improv, and so they're everywhere now.
Did they go to New York first?
Yes, they went to New York first.
And did you do LA. UCB?
I did. I knew those guys, and I performed there, but I wasn't like, I didn't start out with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like doing improv?
I do. I don't do that much of it now.
Yeah.
I do like to do it in, you know, filming and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
If they let me. Sometimes they don't let me.
Yeah. Well, I would say there's a certain show where they definitely let you.
Yeah, they would just keep it running sometimes.
Yeah.
But then there were other times, you know, when they have to go to the next scene, they go, Rich, I'm sorry, we just got to have you do the script.
If you could just say, this way, please.
But then I do the improv anyway.
Yeah, because you're a selfish performer.
Yes.
But that's the other thing about improv over here. Not to say it's selfish in the UK, but compared to, like, say, comedy, the comedy scene in the UK is there's, I don't know, maybe I'm being a bit unfair with this, but it feels like...
you are.
Yeah, improv teaches you to be generous.
Yes, and?
Exactly. You know, it's about getting to the place. It's not about who's the funniest or... I mean,
it's almost a hippie sort of thing.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Because originally it was based on, you know, what children do. Because they go, hey, we're all pirates. Then everybody's a pirate.
Yeah, yeah.
So you do that. You don't go, I'm an astronaut. I'm not a pirate.
Yeah. Whereas back, my experience of live comedy is that if you do stuff on your own or as a pair or maybe a group, you're still just you guys. And you might do 10 minutes on a bill. And so you're always trying to be the best that you can be. But whereas the improv, you can see people. It's like a team sport, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
which is why, in a way, when I went to the UK, I was kind of glad that it wasn't like... Even though we came over doing improv, I was kind of glad to see that sort of different type of comedy. And
yeah. Did you notice a big... What year did you come...
Well, I started doing Edinburgh. In about mid-90s.
Yeah.
And then we got,
What was the show called again? It was the science show.
Modern Problems in Science.
Modern Problems in Science. Now, I first ever did Edinburgh with my... I was at a college for 1 year before I
left.
And we took a play up, the Threepenny Opera. And I remember the Modern Problems in Science.
What, really?
Yeah, because it was...
I remember you in Threepenny Opera. Which penny were you?
I was the second one.
Okay, all right. You had the glasses.
Yeah, right. No, I didn't wear glasses back then. But but I remember it was a show because it had a bit... You had a little bit of...
problem on stage.
You had some problems. No, you had coverage, didn't you?
What do you mean?
There
was a little buzz,
yeah,
right?
There was a buzz.
Well, it was. I think it's a show that translated easily. Like we improvised a university lecture, so we'd get a hypothesis from the audience, like Czechoslovakia can be mailed, and then we'd have to prove it. And they would give us professorships in different topics. Like I'm a professor of what? And they go robotics. So we teach about an hour of this class.
Completely improvised.
Yeah, and try to prove the theory. Sometimes we would, but sometimes we'd be way off base. But it's more about the process and everything.
That sounds like quite a complicated... Like, did you ever get thrown a theory that you had to do, and in your head you're going, I have no idea
happened.
What I'm...
The first time we were on a big stage,
right.
I think we got some Enid Blyton question, and I didn't really know.
Yeah.
Who that was.
Yeah, yeah.
So we learned after that, like, because in
to
America...
Say, I'm sorry, we don't...
Yeah, 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 no. Could we get another suggestion?
Yeah, yeah,
like the Enid Blyton one.
Yeah.
But in the U.S., they pride themselves on, like, taking the very first suggestion, you know, gynecologist.
Yeah.
Is usually that.
That's a popular one, isn't it? So you were doing the Edinburgh Festival. You did it a couple of times in the mid-90s, yeah?
Yeah, well, yeah, I did it. I've done it like 9 times. So we did it as Modern Problems 3 times in a row.
Okay.
And then we split up.
Which there was like helplines to for recovering.
It was
fans.
Pretty bad. Yeah. A lot of people, you know,
a lot of people died
turned to heroin.
So, at what point did you meet Noel and Julian?
In it was the last year we did Modern Problems, and I was sort of at a loss for what to do, and we had a manager, so I said, do you want to represent me like solo? Mm-hmm. And so she said yeah, and I was just sort of over there just hanging out for a little bit, and they said there's a sketch show coming up, do you want to go in and interview? And so I just sort of talked myself into it.
What was the sketch show?
It's called Unnatural Acts.
Of course, yeah.
And I met Julian from that, and yeah. Julian pulled in Noel, and I pulled in Sean Cullen. And
Sean Cullen, mate. What's Sean doing these days?
He's a fireman. Yeah. Did you know that? No, he's huge in Canada. He comes out here every once in a while, and he's...
Sean Cullen, for anyone that listens to this who doesn't know who he is, because he hasn't really done stuff in the UK for a long time.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Genuinely one of the funniest performers I've ever seen. I mean, the show Wood, Cheese and Children.
Yeah.
Did you see that show?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Jesus.
And again, improvisation, but with music and surreal and weird, and people that are fans of like your work would definitely love.
So we all gravitated towards each other. There were other people in the cast, yeah. But we were kind of like, let's do a show together.
Yeah, yeah.
And Julian and Noel were way into this animal thing. Mm-hmm. God knows what this animal thing was. No, about a zoo, and we just started talking about doing it. And Sean couldn't do it that year because I think he had Wood, Cheese, and Children.
Okay, yeah, yeah. It was the same year as the first Boosh.
It was 98 was yeah. The first Boosh show.
So that was the first time I was aware of you. I came to see that show, and I remember
you
seeing
did?
It. Yeah. And
Cried, didn't you?
I cried.
Yeah.
Do you remember that show? The guy cried all... From literally the second the show started... All the way through.
It is pretty tear-inducing.
Yeah, tear-inducing. I saw you in that, and then also you and Sean did some stuff in a show that I was also in, that Gary Reish produced, called Stop the World.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were two women.
Yeah. And yeah. I was like, I like this guy, but I don't want to meet him. And I avoided you for about 5 years.
You did?
Yeah. It wasn't until like... I don't know when it was.
When did we meet?
I want to say...
We were in a knife fight together, weren't we?
That's right. That's right. What year was that knife fight?
It must have been late... It was 2000s.
2001?
Yeah, early 2000s.
Yeah, I reckon. So then the Boosh, obviously, it took a while for that to go from a stage show to a TV show.
Yes, because then it went to radio in 2000. There were three stage shows, and then in 2000...
Wasn't it on something like BBC London or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And then it moved to BBC Two? Radio?
Radio 2? Yeah, maybe.
And then after that, it was like... I guess people could see that it was actually a show. It could be a half-hour show instead of this loose... stage show. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what got the commission
did
for
you
us.
Think
I don't know.
At some point, I remember bumping into Julian before, probably like in 2002 or something.
And he swiped at you like a bear?
Yeah. And we had a knife fight on the tube. A lot of knife fights back in the early noughties.
Oh, it was
a bit like, you know, the Warriors. The film The Warriors. They didn't have night fights. But I remember him feeling like, you know, he just didn't know whether the show would ever get to TV. He was frustrated. And then, you know, cut to a couple of years later and you guys, you're the hottest things in the UK right now.
Well, we had tried for years and everybody was kind of like, yeah, we love the show, but we just can't see it on the TV screen.
But did you find, because you weren't, like, the main two, were you able to, like, sort of come over and do, like, say, come on, guys, what are we doing? Or did you just have to sit and wait? And
well, it was a little bit of both. Sometimes I would say, yes, this should be a show. Let's do a show. And then I would leave and then, you know.
Nothing would happen.
No. Those guys were always trying. And, you know, and then, you know, they said, you know. We're doing a radio show, which Danny Wallace produced, by the way.
I remember, yeah, wow.
So I came over to do that, and then it just sort of all clicked.
Yeah. And then when the show finally went out, it took a couple of years for everyone at the BBC and in the industry to realize it was a ginormous hit.
Well, we didn't really know when we were doing it until we did our first show, like at York. When we started the tour, and we thought, well, we've done this on TV. We don't really know how popular it's going to be.
Which is, because this is, again...
audience.
Again, audience. This is pre-Facebook social media, right? So there was no...
Pre-MySpace.
This was pre-Friends Reunited.
We had an abacus the bus.
But there wasn't like a way of finding out whether there was like, you didn't have a fan page or like people chatting about it online. So you really just didn't know if it was popular or not.
No.
And I remember coming to like one of the shows on that first tour and just could not believe the obsessive fandom that was going on.
It was a lot of fandom and a lot of people dressed up and we looked behind stage. I remember that night because it was like just crazy.
And then you had to extend the dates and do more dates and bigger rooms.
We started out in like a splitter van.
Yeah.
All five of us, you know, Dave Brown and Mike Fielding and then we go, Nolan Julian said, we're getting a tour bus. And we were all like, yay.
And then before you know it, there's no turning back.
Yeah.
The rock and roll began.
And then I had my overdose.
Yeah. Which kind of went a bit under the radar, didn't it?
Yeah. I did a few shows in a coma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I have to say, the fact that it really, you couldn't notice. I don't know if that says.
It's a testament to me.
It's kind of what a professional you are, you know, that you can be pretty much dead. And no one noticed.
But I think you could safely say we were all a bit surprised.
Yeah.
I think, too, like, I would tell Julian and Noel when we came out to the U.S., like, there are a lot of fans out here. And they would go, no, there's going to be five people. And it was just huge.
Yeah, huge. I think they've always...
Huge.
Huge. Is that your Donald Trump?
Yeah.
It's good. I think even going back to the first show they did in Edinburgh, which is in a, like a 100-seater or something, that you could just tell that they have this thing that makes people obsessive about them.
Yeah.
You know, they capture people.
I'm obsessed with them.
I'm not surprised they've supplied you with a large part of your career. How does that feel like when you owe someone everything? What does that feel like? No, because you, going back to the improv thing, you supply so much. You know, you come on and you create your own little piece of that show. And it's so, and knowing you, I know how much that is you. But there must also, in a way, it's a dream job because you don't have to do the heavy lifting.
Well, of course, anything where you're kind of a character and you go in and do your bit and get a laugh and then you go out, of course, that's the dream thing. But, I mean, I just loved every minute of it. I mean, the process is what I like, too. When we created that first series and it was just us in a room. I mean, I miss that more than a lot of things because as the show got bigger... We'd have less time to kind of work on the show. Mm-hmm. It's more like Julian and Noel would write it, and then it would be like, I think by the third series, they were actually working on one of the episodes while we were filming it.
So,
we didn't have as much time to just, you know.
So in the early days, you were very much in part of the early creative process.
Yeah, because we were just trying to figure out what it was, and it was, I just... found myself just getting, I could do this like for 40 years.
Wow. I'd love to see you as an 80-year-old Bob Fossil. Actually, that kind of makes sense. And then how old would that make Chester, what was his name? Chester Pop?
Oh, Lester. Corncrake would be 180. Yeah.
I think he was my favorite of your characters.
Lester Corncrake.
I thought it was wonderful. Then after Mighty Boosh, was there a strange transition going into, because you did Tiny Acts of Rebellion, which was very popular, the book.
Oh, I just decided I'd write a book. I don't know if that was a good idea or not, but...
Did you enjoy doing that?
Yes.
As someone that's, you know, most of his...
Adult life
is just pissed around for a living. No, someone like, you know, you did improv and you're very much a performer to sit and write at a laptop every day.
You know what? I couldn't have done it without deadlines. They go, you got to finish this many pages by this date. Yeah. If they didn't have that, I wouldn't be done. I'd still not be done. I'd be...
Did you not find it daunting
asleep
at times? Where you were just like, I just don't know if I can do this. Maybe I need to...
No, but I did a little bit because, you know, you think about it, it's like, yeah, writing a book. You've written a book.
I've never written a book. No, I've...
You will write one tonight in your bed.
It's this hypnosis you're doing on me. What if I did? What if tomorrow... Rich, I wrote a book last night.
Yeah, then I know. Yeah. I know my powers.
I just find a book... Like, you write a script and then you have to go... Like, if it's a half-hour sitcom, you go back and rewrite 30 pages. The thought of going back and rewriting 300 pages of dense description...
Yeah, well, luckily, I would write them and then move on and then they would give me notes and I'd rewrite. Yeah, so, you know...
The editor... It must be so important in that.
Yeah, it took about 4 months.
Okay.
Of intense writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you sweating at times?
Yeah. But I mean, I like it when I just have one thing to work on, 12 words a second.
Okay.
I like it when I've got a one project thing. We talked about this.
Yeah.
And then you just focus on that. And
then
it's
done.
Yeah. And I get distracted very easily by shiny cups and things.
Does that mean that here you get distracted less because you can't just walk out the house and bump into loads of people you know?
Socially, I don't get distracted, but I find ways to get distracted. Cool. Like,
becomes a skill of a writer all on its own.
Yeah. Oh, look, a bug crawling up the wall. I'm going to follow that for a couple of days. Like, I'm the type of person that has to have an assignment or work. Mm-hmm. If it's left up to me, it's hard. It's hard.
I've always got the impression that it's hard for you. I've always got the impression that that you don't care about the scenario you're in. You just love to perform. And what I mean by that is you're not concerned about like whether...
I'll play Hitler. Is that what you're saying? I don't know if I'd play Hitler, would I?
No, I don't mean characters and things. Don't care if you're playing to 4 people or 4,000 people or if you're in a show that's going to be huge or a show that's no one's going to... You just love doing...
Yes, and I also get nervous the same kind of level.
Do you?
Yeah, because those 4 people could be the mafia. I mean, I don't know who the... I just feel nervous when I
really
go out.
That really is a pre-stage paranoia on a new level.
What if there's the mafia out there? Any mafia?
Oh, God.
No, but
Are there any extreme terrorists in tonight?
Plus, it also depends if you're on your own versus in a cast.
Well, after my sitcom, directly after the show, or after the third season...
Name drop.
Name drop. I used to have a show, guys.
Was this in Rome?
This is in Rome, eating al fresco. I played to, like, for the first time in my career, big crowds and big theatres. And then 2 years later, I did a tour, and it was like half the size because people have short memories.
Right.
And
Dan Clare?
How not to live your... what? And it takes a bit of adjusting to... But actually, weirdly, I sort of enjoyed the smaller theatres more than the big ones. But that's something that I've always thought when I've watched you perform, you never, seemingly, maybe I'm wrong, you never seem to be affected by any of that exterior stuff.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
You... But the thing is, too, when a show gets popular, you can sort of ride a crest of a wave.
Yeah.
For laughs, like you'd say something that's in the show and get a laugh. Whereas if it's a smaller audience, and especially if they don't know you, it's like the laughs have to be earned.
Oh my God.
That's why I get nervous. Like I got more nervous when I was doing gigs in like York and Hull, like as a stand up.
Right.
Because it's like some of these people don't know who I am and you know.
You actually have to be. It's like the comedian, you know, the Jerry Seinfeld documentary. And they'll
give you 5 minutes
based on who you are.
Yeah,
which is true. But he was brave enough to let them show a clip where he was sort of dying. I mean, I say dying.
He was the bravest man ever. I would have to say.
Really?
Yeah.
To let people see that, or but he's sort of right, and in a way, it's worse when they do know you and you die. Because
yeah.
Then you know they're going to be talking about it.
Oh, jeez, I thought that guy was good.
I mean, like, he's worth half a billion. He should be funny.
He's ranting about the mafia. What's that all about? Just sort of dribble.
I loved the live show of Tiny Acts of Rebellion. I thought that was...
I actually heard you laughing in the audience.
Yeah, I thought that was one of my favorite things of yours.
Well, because it was kind of like I was a person...
Yeah, I think it was different to what I got to know. For you,
right.
There was some kind of linear, like there was a character that we saw all the way through rather than the sort
right,
of more
right.
randomness of previous stuff. But it still had your like complete insane sort of humor in it.
And of course, Arnab was in it, so
Arnab
that was
Chanda.
Hilarious.
Very, very fun. How sad is it that Arnab Chanda does not do stand-up comedy or live comedy?
I think he gets it from all angles, right? You've got to do stand-up. He
Which
will
really,
eventually.
Knowing him well, I think makes him want to do it less,
yep.
not more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think eventually he will do it.
Yeah. Let's hope so. Let's start. Hashtag Arnab back on stage.
But he'll be like in the Yukon Territory or something and do it.
And then in between your solo live stuff and book and
yeah,
the book,
I masturbate.
You you did the even more cult, let's say, TV show Snuffbox with Matt Berry. Now that
hyper cult,
uber cult. That should be said in a Dutch accent, I think.
Uber cult.
Is that Dutch or German? The uber cult Snuffbox, how did that come about? Because I always thought of you and Matt as an odd pairing, both socially and on
really?
Screen. Yeah, a little bit.
Well, we kind of met. We met on the set of Mighty Boosh.
Yeah.
Because we were paired together.
He was in the first series.
Yes, yeah. as my boss,
yeah.
Dixon Bainbridge. And we just sort of hung out. We started talking. And then a producer suggested, like, well, you guys should do something together.
Yeah.
And initially we were pitching, like, real... stuff. I think we had one thing idea about ghost hunters and
like,
you know,
narrative stuff.
Yeah, narrative stuff. And then all of a sudden they go, I think it's because Little Britain went up to BBC One. They were
right.
going, BBC Three is looking for a sketch show. Do you guys want to do a sketch show? Basically, you have to do a sketch show.
So do we a were like, now.
We didn't want to necessarily do one.
Yeah.
We were kind of like, that's...
It really shows, by the way.
Yeah, no, but what we did was we did it the way we wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So it was kind of melding a bunch of different things.
So you had your characters that you played sort of throughout the show. It was in like a gentleman's club or something?
Yeah.
Was it? Yeah?
Yeah.
So that kind of gave it a bit of a...
A grounding.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Then, but I know so many people that love Snuffbox. It was one of those shows where you really are like, oh, why didn't that... get more of a chance?
Because two people watched it?
Yeah, and me and this other guy I know.
Yeah.
And we constantly talk about, why didn't
Oh my gosh. I almost get mad because people go, that's my favorite show. It's like...
Well, funnily enough, I was listening to a I was listening to a Marc Maron podcast, and he interviewed one of my favourite singer-songwriters, Joseph Arthur. And he's a guy that's never been like a mainstream kind of star. And he was saying the same thing, that people come up to him all the time and say, you should be bigger, man. And he
said, shut up.
Yeah, and he said it's taken him quite a few years to come to terms, rather than get annoyed and angry with that
You comment. Should be the hugest thing in the world, man.
Because really what that comment means is, I like what you do.
Right.
But why do we have to then equate that into the success of it? And
yeah. Who's huge now anyway?
Because we all want to be. But you did, didn't you take Snuff Box to Comic Con?
What did we do? No, we took the Boosh to Comic Con.
Did you?
Yeah.
I was sure I saw us.
Matt went down there one time.
Okay. I think it had a bigger audience than you. I always feel like the channels back home in the UK are a little bit, don't always... Maybe it happens here as well.
They never re-aired it on BBC Three.
But I sometimes think that unless it's winning awards or getting ridiculously big viewing figures, people...
It's done.
It's done.
It evaporates.
But also...
I hate that.
The fact that the Boosh did two seasons before everyone realised just how big it
is. Well, yeah, and The Office was about to get canned.
Yeah. Well, listen, anyway, look, we always get our guests to pick a guilty pleasure, a film or a TV show that they either think is terrible, but they love it anyway, or they think is underrated.
This was difficult.
Why?
Because there's so many, there's a lot of comedy shows that I watch again and again that have loads of catchphrases, because that way you and your friends can say the cat, like Caddyshack, Raising Arizona. But this one is actually not a comedy, and I love to watch it every time it's on. I don't know why. I'm just drawn to it like a bug to wax.
What is the film?
Wall Street.
What? I'm
it's
surprised
so quotable.
That you for think it's a that you would consider it a, maybe a guilty pleasure?
Why?
Well, isn't it considered a good film?
Can I get another one? Then?
No,
it's
I'm a
some
big fan.
People hate it though.
Do they?
Yeah, I've watched. It's been polarizing for me.
Yeah.
To see people disgusted by it.
Yeah. I love the film. I think I'm a huge Michael Douglas fan.
Yeah, yeah.
He's amazing.
Yeah. Right? And this is his ultimate film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's amazing in it. How do you feel about watching Charlie Sheen back in that film now we know everything since?
I don't even think about it. He's just such a different person.
Yeah.
I mean, I can separate that because I'm a bit of adult and I can... But I know some people.
By the way, I'm not just saying, like, because of all the exploits, but he was in Platoon and then Wall Street, and he was like, he was
the hottest thing on earth.
Thing. And then only a few years later, he was the guy that did Hot Shots, Duh, and like silly comedies, and then he did a sitcom for years. And it was like, oh, at one point, he was sort of a serious actor.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah. So. Yeah. What I kind of mean more like artistically, if that's a fair use of the word. Like the fact that he, at the time, I took him seriously.
I did too.
Go, oh, there's that really, it's that guy that does loads of comedy doing a serious performance.
It's sad. He will again go back to serious drama.
No,
tonight.
Yeah.
When you write your book.
Do you get what I'm saying at all?
So the thing is, though, I know what you're saying. You're saying when you watched him at the time, you thought, this is a hot shit actor.
Yeah.
And now looking back after all he's done.
Yeah. You're kind of like, oh, it's...
Winning. Like, I don't see that. I just look at it as
for
if
what
it were...
What it
yeah.
Is. Yeah, you're making me sound like I have absolutely no ability to...
You're... you have asthma.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a great film. I don't really consider it a guilty pleasure.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's an actual
What if
good
I
film.
Played it backwards? No. Damn.
Does
so
it have, does
I
it have
fucked
sort
up.
Of really dated music and stuff like that in it?
Well, it's got David Byrne. Stuart Copeland does the soundtrack.
My God.
He's great.
Amazing. This
well, I don't
people.
Know. I mean, Rotten Tomatoes has it around... A little below 7 out of 10.
Okay, that's pretty
good. I mean, I don't know. What's a guilty pleasure?
People ask me what my guilty pleasure always, not on the show, but off record, and I have got the one that I think I would pick, but I thought of another one the other day. I'm trying to think of...
I know what it is.
Go on.
Ferris Bueller.
No. I don't. I actually don't like Ferris Bueller. And people think I'm crazy for not
really?
Liking it. Yeah, I've got...
I used to not like it, but I don't like the fact that people just laud it so much.
Yeah.
That I'm... Yeah.
I've got a bit of a... I think I just don't like the spoilt brat lead character. I'm a bit like... People like him used to make my life hell when I was a kid.
Yeah, they're
get away
so
with
entitled.
Everything entitled. But, no, I think one of my guilty pleasures would be... And I'm only saying this to give you an example.
Okay, all right.
I was talking about this film the other day with someone. Couples Retreat.
Now, what?
I know. People would say that's
Pete Serafinovitz.
Who is brilliant in
He's great in it.
He's great in it. But I enjoy that film.
Best thing about
when
it.
When it comes on, I find myself watching that film.
Okay, all
so
right.
That is a guilty pleasure.
Okay, here's one. This was just on the other day, The Cutting Edge, where this hockey player is teamed with a figure skater, and they have to learn to skate to go into the Olympics.
I'm totally in... Wait,
yeah,
can I see it?
You had me at cutting. I guess you can see it on. Do I need to plug?
No, you don't.
The streaming service?
No.
Okay.
So, well, look, I think maybe Wall Street is more polarizing than I thought it was.
I think it might be.
Yeah. Okay. Tweet in if you hate.
Hey,
Wall
everybody.
Crank that knob.
At I love Wall Street or I hate.
That's not a hashtag that's going to catch on, Rich.
Oh, okay.
Well, look, it's been a pleasure chatting to you in podcast in the car park, and it's been a pleasure to see you, Rich.
Can we see each other again, or is this it?
No, the second I hit pause on this...
You're going to interview someone else?
I'm off. I'm gone.
Oh, jeez.
Before we go, what's the... we were going to pick two of your songs.
I miss you.
Okay. Let's wait until I've stopped recording. What's the song you've got to play out for us?
Love on the Rocks from the jazz singer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, I just love to sing it. Love on the Rocks. It's not even good. Love on the Rocks. Ain't no surprise. I'll pour you a drink and I'll tell you some lies. Blah, 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 blah. More to that effect.
Yeah. Oh, I was really enjoying that. Rich,
first they say they want you. No, that's it.
We don't need to play it.
Okay, all right.
Just before we do play the song, have you got anything people can see coming out at all soon?
Yes. No. I'm doing another round of Questionable Science.
Mm-hmm.
On Comedy Central, but you can see the old ones on the Comedy Central website. Their comic is called Comic Con. No, Comic. It's called. did you put booze in the coffee?
Yeah, I was just going to say.
It's called Questionable Science.
Can people see it in the UK?
Never.
Good.
Yes, no, they can. On YouTube, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And anything else? You just shot something for the BBC Three.
Yes, it's coming out, I think, next month in October or something. It's called Sexy Murder. It's on BBC Three. It's really funny.
And it's like a...
It's really funny.
Really funny. It's like a pastiche of...
I'll be murder documentaries like The Jinx and Making Up a Murderer. And
this is great. I mean, the company that made it must have been right hot off on the... tail end.
It's cutting edge, to turn a phrase from the previous thing I said.
Cool. Well, this is Love on the Rocks, Rich. You have been an absolutely beautiful man.
And I was waiting for something to drop, disgusting.
I'm not going to neg you. You've been great.
Thank you. I'm glad you came here, even though it was under the pretense of a podcast.
Yeah. And I'm glad that the only way to see you was by interviewing you and flying all the way to the American states.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only way.
Okay.
I gotta go.
Okay, bye.
Love on the rocks. Ain't no surprise.
Just pour me a drink and I'll tell you some lies. Got nothing to lose, so you just sing the blues all the time. Gave you my heart, gave you my soul. You left me alone here with nothing to hold. Yesterday's gone, now all I want is a smile. They say they want you. Hey, how they really need you. Suddenly you find you're out there, walking in a storm. And when they know they have you, then they really have you. Nothing you can do or say. You got to leave, just get away. We all you need what you need. You can say what you want. Not much you can do when the feeling is gone. Maybe blue skies above, but it's cool when your love's on the rise. On the rocks, it ain't no big surprise. Just pour me a drink and I'll tell you my lies. Yesterday's gone, and now all I want is a smile.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.